Hello, and welcome to the Marketing Times Analytics Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Sofranis, and today I'm on with Max Green. Max, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Max Green. I'm the Director of Marketing Analytics at REI, the largest outdoor consumer cooperative in the country.
What are some of the things that matter that you measure in terms of marketing effectiveness?
It really depends what we're measuring. A lot of what we're trying to do is on the, in terms of where we spend our time, is measuring things that we maybe don't have the best read on today. So in terms of where we're resourcing, but when I think about marketing effectiveness, I think about the full marketing funnel from brand awareness, which we have certain measures and certain tools to measure that. Very different than lower funnel, like growth marketing and direct response channels, which those have a lot of analytics behind them and very different lenses that you can look through to understand what's effective and what's not.
What are the different types of campaigns that you would run, and how would the metrics that you collect differ between those campaigns?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in terms of how I think about B2C company or retailer investing in marketing, there's a few different things you can go after. I think a lot of retailers are trying to reach new consumers, trying to introduce their brand into new spaces. So I think a lot of retailers will look to brand awareness, brand consideration campaigns to do that. I think there are some great short-term metrics as well as long-term metrics to measure those. So if you're running something on a social platform, many of them today allow you to do brand lift studies directly in platform. There are a number of other tools that you can use outside of social channels, more in the display and advertising space, that could also give you some incremental lifts to understand when you reach an audience, how are you changing their perception of your brand? Are you able to recognize the brand? Did the ad change how you perceive and feel about the brand? So those are all great ways, I think, for upper funnel investments and really trying to, like I said, find that new audience. When you're talking about more day-to-day, trying to drive retention and grow your business and drive demand, I think a lot of that is going to be coming from your probably performance channels, which might be a lot of Google, maybe a little bit of social, as well as any direct channels that you have with your customer. So maybe you have email lists, or you're sending texts, or you're sending direct mail pieces as well. All of those are going to have a different way of looking at them. But I think in terms of understanding incremental value, I think there's a lot of great tools out there when it comes to match market testing and understanding what's the incremental lift at a geographic level, and then comparing that to your overall spend to understand here's incrementality, let's say, for a paid search investment, really different than a direct marketing channel where maybe you can actually do a test and control experimentation at the consumer level, which would also get you that incrementality of what is this driving specifically in terms of sales tomorrow. And then what I think is really helpful when you think about up and down the funnel is what are those different tools that you can use to look at everything all at once. So I know a lot of brands are using, especially if they have a large e-com presence, they're looking at last touch metrics or last click metrics, or maybe they have an MTA set up, or maybe a media mix model.
I'm so glad you mentioned all of that, first of all, but especially the direct marketing. How do you reconcile incrementality that's being driven by the program versus the true value of the program, which is less incrementality, more direct sales push and lift through increasing close rates?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think I talk a lot about triangulation. Sometimes we have three ways of looking at a channel. Sometimes we have one, sometimes we have four or more. But I think if you have at least three, you're probably in a good place. So when I think about incrementality and measurement in general, typically we would have what we would call a swim lane metric, or a metric that's provided by a marketing platform, whether that's your email service provider, social channel, Google, whoever. And that's going to be, as far as that channel can make it, the rosiest picture possible. Obviously, there are measurement constraints in terms of if you're an omnichannel retailer like REI, you have both e-com and in-store sales. And so those swim lane metrics are really going to be measuring the marketing channel's impact on e-com. But again, it's the rosiest picture. So often marketers will use things like view through and maybe potentially for as long as 30 days. And depending on the consideration of your product, maybe that is the true incremental value. But I think typically it's probably a lot less. And it's probably, again, that's a very rosy picture. And then on the entirely other end of the spectrum, if you're just looking at last click, that's going to heavily weight towards channels that we would call closers, or those channels that consumers are engaging with right at the end of their shopping journey, not necessarily what put them in that purchase path to begin with, or really what got them interested in your brand in particular. For, let's say, if you're a multi-brand retailer, why buy this product specifically from you? And so when I think about swim lane, that's like the rosiest picture possible. When I think about last click, that's probably the most conservative view possible, especially for more upper funnel investments. And so that's where I think is helpful. I think incremental is helpful to understand what's that Goldilocks or like best possible estimate of what the total impact of that channel is. I'm not sure if that exactly answered what you were asking.
In the case that direct marketing is good in a last touch perspective and weak in an incremental perspective, what's the fix?
I think it probably depends on the business, what that last click attribution looks like, if there are offline sales you're capturing. So for an omnichannel retailer like REI, you think about more than half of our sales are coming from in-store. We have a huge and very active member base that is very loyal and very interested in what we have and what's new this season and what's the best gear for this specific activity and how has that technology changed, even from a fashion perspective of what are people in the outdoors wearing and how do I get the latest fits. And so when I think about our core consumer that we're speaking to almost 365 days, let's say via email, that customer is going to show up in store in a way that there may be other customers that are just out there online. They don't really care who they're buying from. They're just looking for a great deal this minute. Our email subscriber base, they're going to show up in store in a huge way. And so by looking at incremental, we're able to see both channels, email, e-com, and in store. And that provides us a much broader picture of then what those individual direct marketing communications are driving beyond just last click.
That's a good point. And yes, I was specifically referring to like acquisition direct mail rather than the whole suite. Because yes, organic email would change the dynamic from an incremental perspective. But for from an acquisition direct mail perspective, which the purpose is really not to just drive new sales, but to capture those journeys that are already in motion.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think what's really challenging about finding true incrementality there as well is you don't know necessarily, depending on the vendors you're working with and how sophisticated of a pathing data set you might have, or if you have an MTA set up, you don't necessarily know how many other marketing touches happened on the way to that piece of direct mail. And so I think where it gets really challenging, unless you're layering tests on top of each other, it gets hard to know what was the value of that specific last touch that reached the customer versus was it actually that maybe 1 + 1 = 4, where there was a more upper funnel, maybe rich video ad that the consumer engaged with before they got that piece. And so you could certainly understand how incrementality and last click can get lost in those, especially those acquisition journeys that aren't as clear as maybe a retention journey.
So is that something that MTA would help sort out?
For now, I think with cookies changing, cookie deprecation in general, we've already seen a lot of bifurcation in the measurement space anyway with mobile and iOS changes. But I think with these Chrome changes coming in Q4, it's just going to get that much harder to build a real MTA that stitches a full consumer's journey together. So I think individual vendors will have an okay picture of generally here's your incremental for this tactic. But unless you're setting up, we're obviously not living in this world yet, but I think as we get there, unless you're setting up some pretty sophisticated measurement that's probably at the geography or some sort of contextual targeting level, it's going to be really hard to tell like exactly what was in a consumer's path, not necessarily engaging with your digital assets, but out in the wild web, if you will.
How do you see the cookie deprecation going? Do you think there will be a suitable replacement? How do you think that will ultimately affect the industry?
For MTA specifically?
Yeah, and advertising targeting.
Yeah, I think MTA has, I think my guess is we've seen the peak in terms of third-party MTAs. I think homegrown MTAs that are more session based on internal data and traffic to your own site is helpful. But I think if you look at maybe what's most effective, it really depends on what's been effective for your brand. But if you look at more broadly reaching and broadly engaging marketing channels, those are going to be really hard to stitch together, I think, in the future. So I think we're going to see more reliance on like media lift studies, like I mentioned before, that are specific to in platform. So what is this Meta ad unit doing for me? What is this PMax ad unit doing for me? That's going to be, I think, like I said, more, we're going to rely on those things more. And then I think there's going to be a new or maybe a resurgence of reliance on media mix, because there isn't going to be as much stitching. And so I think a lot of these, I think last click will still be there, but I think these very rich paths that a number of data vendors have been able to provide in order to create NTAs, again, external NTAs, not necessarily session-based. I just think those are going to be really challenged. It's going to be a hard business to be in for an NTA provider.
Yeah. Do you think that the industry will shift and start to just make the customer disclosures a little bit more obvious? And maybe that wasn't worded properly, but basically, do you think that the businesses will shift to force the customers to accept providing more data in place of being able to track it somewhat automatically?
Yeah, I think that's possible. I really, going back to one of the first things I said, I do think aligning on what the goal of all your campaigns are is critically important. And so I think there's going to be great solutions for understanding how is this marketing impacting, let's say, brand awareness, or how is this marketing impacting demand tomorrow or this week? I really think it's those like that the in-between that's going to be really challenging. And so I guess I see it less as, hey, what are we going to force consumers to get into, or what are publishers going to force consumers to get into in terms of giving away data? And I think it's going to be more about, are we willing to make less, maybe more directional bets in terms of where we're putting our marketing based on what we believe our biggest opportunities are for the brand, for our brand, not necessarily. I think we're just going to have to get used to less certainty, I guess is the easiest way to say it.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you but it's see a good question. And I mean, I'll be the first to say I'm not necessarily an expert on consumer privacy or where that industry is headed. And I've been in marketing analytics for over a decade. All I've seen is that there's these rise of, hey, here's some brand new data sets that we're getting from banks, or here's these brand new data sets we're getting from these third-party publishers, and then they get stale and then they don't work as well over time. And so I just think there's going to be less and less data. And the consumer, who's the same as the voter, is they continue to vote with their dollars and real votes to say, I want more privacy. I don't want these marketers all up in my business, understanding everything about me. And not necessarily speaking on behalf of all of REI, but like the way I think about how we engage with our customers, our members, is we're trying to add as much value as we can to their lives. We're trying to get more people outside. We're trying to basically make people's lives better. And so that's why we're marketing to them. Hey, if you've got an extra dollar, we'd love to get you into a new outdoor activity. And keeping that frame of reference, it's okay. So is it also on my agenda to get you to sign a disclosure agreement so that I can track you as you go across the internet? Like, not really. That's not really like top 50 priorities I think we would have as a marketing department. And so I think it's less about like, how do we squeeze that, and more about how do we leverage what's out there to add the right value in consumer journeys in the right places.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm curious, do you see any other risks ahead with any other kinds of media measurement due to privacy or other changes in the industry?
It's a good question. Maybe we can come back to that if something pops into my mind. I think there's a lot of gaps in general of, oh man, I wish we had better data on this, but I can't say there's a bunch of stuff like around the corner where I'm like, oh, this type of measurement is going to get worse, for instance.
Okay. What are some of the gaps in marketing analytics and in measurement of media effectiveness that you see right now?
Yeah, I think like we've talked a little bit about last click and like how that's favored. I think in general, as an industry, we probably spent the last 5+ years having, maybe this is true of every company, but it's like that last, just that ROAS of just how do we crank that thing and just get the most out of it. And obviously where we are right now, I think just in general with a little bit of, not a ton, but a little bit of economic softening and the growth, especially in some categories we've seen over the last 3 years, 4 years, as we've kind of emerged from the pandemic is waning. I think there are a number of retailers fishing in smaller ponds, if you will. And as we run out of that last click ROAS juice to squeeze, question of like, where does that next dollar go? Or maybe even where do those last click dollars that we were, or what we're putting towards last click ROAS, where do those dollars go? I think that's a big question. And I think there are a lot of very interesting channels out there. I think you see retailers doing more with, let's say, affiliates and influencers. I think we see a lot of our, even like the largest players, like your Google and your Meta, they're coming out with new ad units that are more mid-funnel in shopping journeys, that are more about, hey, discover our product, less about, we're going to follow you around with the product you just looked at. And so as those things emerge, and as we've leaned into them over the last few years, that just it gets harder to say what's the total impact of this specific ad unit or this specific tactic when we know that it's not what's driving the last click. And so that's honestly what's most top of mind for me, is for things that we can't do market level testing on, for things we can't do consumer level holdouts on, how do we value those things and how do we understand them in terms of the total marketing mix? When their goal is still ROAS, it is still about having a really strong marketing investment, but it's not about driving that ultimate or that sale in this minute, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I also wanted to ask, when you're calculating ROAS, are you using incremental effectiveness and return on, you know, in terms of sales, or are you looking at a direct sales measurement? What's the ideal?
Yeah, ideal would be if we could have one measurement that was incremental and that was you could apply to every marketing channel you have, but I haven't seen that. So I would say we use incremental when we can to understand how much value are we actually adding with this marketing lever. But then in other areas where you can't have that, or the path between the ad and that purchase is much more obscured, that's where we do rely on those other metrics, whether it's direct response, like you said, or maybe it's more like media mix. I think I mentioned triangulation, but I do think about that a lot. If we're really only looking at this from one way, unless it's incremental, and we are really sure that incremental has been tested over time and is reliable as a, not only as a measure, but as a predictor of future behavior and future response from that marketing, then we're going to try to look at it two or three different ways to understand how it relates, especially to other channels as we're thinking about fine-tuning our marketing mix.
And when you're talking about distributing spend between different media channels from an analytics perspective, how do you go about that?
I have a to-do to make a slide on that next week. It's a great question. And I think it changes depending on the tools and the goals of the time. So I think the tools we have are, I don't want to say static, but that's probably what's been the most consistent, where we have some idea of what's our media mix. I mean, like, what is the correlated ROAS associated with some sort of media mix, and understanding of what all of our channels are driving at a low level. But then we're also looking at what we would call last click, and we're also looking at incremental for the channels that we can calculate that. And depending on what the goals are, I think that then dictates guides the hierarchy of where we'd invest. So if we're at a time where we feel really good about how we're engaging our existing member base, and we're at a time where we think we can reach deeper into an acquisition pool, that's really different than at a time when we think the acquisition pool is maybe a little drier and we're really trying to drive growth for the co-op from our existing members. So I think it really depends on the goals and the objectives of campaigns and also our strategic plan and things like that.
Yeah. And I'm sorry I didn't ask earlier, but what was your career trajectory like to get to this role that you're in right now in marketing analytics?
Yeah, great question. I got a master's in economics pretty basically right out of after school, after college. And then I went to I worked for a nonprofit for a little while. And then I moved into education technology. So I worked for an online university where I was looking at student behavior as well as some operations analysis. Did a little bit of data science there, but a lot of analytics and reporting. And then from there moved to Nielsen, where I did a little bit of media mix modeling for large CPG clients. From there, I moved to REI, where I led what we call database marketing, which is all of our audience targeting, segmentation, and testing for our direct marketing channels. I moved into another role at REI where I took over marketing planning, which does all of our business planning for marketing. So how are we going to allocate budget like we were just talking about, as well as all of our enterprise reporting, weekly analysis, monthly analysis, quarterly analysis, a lot of that enterprise, those enterprise reporting pieces. I like to say business planning is our Rosetta Stone, where marketers are targeting these different KPIs that are sometimes nuanced, but our finance teams especially don't necessarily know what to make of, okay, so you got a point of awareness. What does that mean? And so we do a lot of that translation for them. And then most recently was able to grow out a marketing, we call it marketing channel analytics, but really an optimization group that's focused on being our marketing channels better optimize what they're doing. And I'd say that the path we're on now is, I think we've done a lot in terms of helping channels understand what they're driving. And now we're also working on what are the inputs for channels. So what are the insights that, let's say, our email marketers and our social marketers and our performance marketing team, what are the insights that they're actually getting about the business that will help them day to day as well?
Gotcha. I'm sure in roles where you're in analytics, you're the middleman between teams that might not understand all of the data, and you have to be in the middle of these somewhat philosophical fights and give the hard truth when sometimes that's all you can do is just say, here's what we're measuring. How do you go about these like occasional conflicts, if you see them ever, between teams and you're bringing the data into the situation? How do you navigate those difficult situations?
Yeah, and I don't even know if I would say it's hard truths as much as we have these different lenses and we have these different ways of measuring success. And so I think I've seen some people put themselves and all of us in challenging situations where it's, oh, but growing this thing, this will drive this very particular outcome. So this is what we have to lean into. And what I try to do is help everyone take a step back and say, what are we all trying to do? What is the largest, most important thing that we're trying to drive right now? And so I think having solid strategy, solid measurement in place, those are all kind of dependencies to avoiding those situations I think you're speaking to. In terms of when you getting in the room and everyone has their own data point in their head and no one's necessarily going to be happy with an outcome of, let's say, how we're allocating budget that quarter or a particular measurement of something that we were measuring and we all agreed this is how we're going to measure it. And then we have the number, and then the people who were really excited to do the study aren't happy with the number. I don't know if there's like a great way. There is a great way to handle this. Or if you have a book suggestion, I'd love to read it. But I think in general, I think one thing, I guess, here's how I'll actually answer this question. One thing I didn't appreciate early enough in my career is how important narrative building is when it comes to reporting and delivering insights. And so this idea of the people that are actually doing the work, they're the ones with the answers of why and how and what is this supposed to do and what's working and what's not working. We measure in order to understand how effective it is. So totally understand that you sent this thing and it went to millions of people and thousands of them engaged with it. That's great. If that's what you're trying to do, that's great. I can now tell you if that then drove the outcome that you were seeking for the business or not. But that's different than, were you successful operationally in deploying the thing that you wanted to get out into the world? And so I think having both of those truths of what was the tactic we were trying and did we deploy that successfully and are you a successful and competent marketer? That's a different question than did it actually drive the outcome? And as much as we can then, going back to what's our learning agenda? What's our strategy? Why did we do this in the first place? What did we learn and how do we go forward? I think that's how you make everyone look and feel good. It's like we set out on this for a reason. We did it. Here's what we learned. I'm so glad we learned it. Now we're either going to do it every week from here until it stops working, or we tried it. Let's move on.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. And it also makes building a narrative also makes your insights more useful, and you're doing a lot of the heavy lifting for them. And so it just makes you as an analytics person more valuable to the business and the information more receivable, because the opposite side is is weather reporting. It's just saying, here's how this metric changed and that metric changed. And then you're putting all of the work on the business teams. And yeah, that's an amazing point. What are some other things you've...
I can't tell you how many times I say, like, how should we think about this? I think is like the best question that you can ask, especially of an analyst, maybe who's more junior in their career, because I think a lot of times they will just, they're looking at this data all day. And I remember getting told earlier in my career, you're the one that looks at this data all day. What does it mean? And I'm like, what do you mean? What does it mean? This is up 5%. That's down 10%. You read the table. Everyone knows what this means, but they don't. And they don't have the time, like especially executives or more senior leaders, or even people who are middle management, but they're being pulled in a million directions. They don't have the time to really sit with it and think about it the way that you do.
So as an analytics person, what have you learned that makes you like an effective at analytics? What are some of the skills to build and just in general? Yeah, I guess skills to build is the best way to put it, to become effective.
Yeah, I don't feel qualified to answer this question anymore. I'm not in the tool every single day anymore, the tools every day. When I started, I was like my first real like data science-y tool was Stata. So I just feel old now. But if you asked me 5 years ago, I would have been like, hey, get started in R and Python, go to W3 Schools, which is like a super easy free website, learn a little bit of SQL, learn some like very basic Excel stuff, and like you're off to the races. I think especially the last 2 years, we've got AI coming in. You can get right answers from AI. You can get some wrong answers from AI. A lot of people are using it for this stuff. I do think the most important thing for people to learn, I think, is what are the things that you should do when you are going after XYZ. So if you are running an incremental test procedurally, like what are you doing to make sure that like the control and the test group are clean? What are you doing before the test? What are you doing after the test is run to make sure that if you saw a 5% lift, that 5% lift is statistically significant? There are tools that can just tell you those things. But if you're like the only data person around or the most senior data, like you just have to know that stuff. And unless you have amazing 15-year memory going back to stats, or you're somebody with a master's or a PhD in economics, statistics, analytics, something like that, it's just not going to be as obvious, especially if you're like working your way up as just like a business person to an analytics person. And so I do think there's some like fundamentals there. In terms of tools that I think a lot of people are getting into that I'm seeing growth in, I do think R and Python are still sticking around, especially for custom analytics things. I think you see it on every job post for an analyst role, some sort of data visualization. So whether that's Tableau or Looker, or I know there are a few more, maybe like Power BI, which I've never used personally, but there's a number of those that I think people just expect. Like you can procedurally, like I said, visualize data. And then I do think there's some level of expectation of you can query a database, whether it's cloud or on-prem. You understand maybe a little bit of ETL or reverse ETL, where you're used to moving data around and cleaning it and potentially combining data sets from different sources. I think the landscape's changing, but I think the tools, many of them are still going to be used for some time.
So what is the career trajectory when you're talking about starting in an analytics, like a heavy analytics SQL role, to a more leadership analytics role? What are the skills that need to be built to get to the next level?
Yeah, I go back to what I was saying a couple minutes ago, but I think the most important thing for junior analysts, very junior analysts, is like, you've got to be getting what you're producing has to be right. That's the very first thing, is how do you get into a database, not assume you understand what everything means, find the experts, really understand the data that you're looking at. How do you produce analysis then that adds value? I think that has to do mostly almost with partnership. So if you have the technical understanding of what the data is, you understand what your business question you're trying to answer is, I think the next step is really understanding the business to understand, why is this question being asked? How do I answer it in the right way? And I don't mean the right way as in, I got asked if this metric moved up or down last year. That's like understanding the physical question you're asked. The right way is, why did they ask me this? And then therefore, what is the actual question I should be answering? And it might not be the exact thing that you were told. And it also might be something that already exists. So that's another thing that I think is hard for more junior analysts, is to see that, especially in larger organizations, there are a ton of people. A lot of them have probably already looked at this once, twice. They've been there 30 years, maybe 15 times. And so really find the experts. That's another, I think, tip. So I guess to recap, I would say make sure you're doing the technical aspects of your job really well. And you're, as much as you can, catching your own errors, because there are errors. You can't just write a query and be done. You've got to make sure the data makes sense. The second is building those really strong partnerships with your stakeholders. And the third is understanding that whether you are on a centralized team or a decentralized team, there are going to be analysts that have touched something very similar to what you're doing. And so building those internal, the analytics community relationships, is going to be critical to making sure that you're not producing something that conflicts with something that's already created, or is potentially leads us down a path that we've already been down that we already know where it goes. So we can answer it in that way too.
Yeah.
So I guess a lot of partnership to answer your question of like, how do you get to that next level?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then eventually I imagine learning how to communicate a narrative that the data is telling you and assist with decision making. I think that's also a big piece, because you become somewhat of a trusted neutral third party even within the business, where they're like, what does the data say, Max? What should we do? Like, agnostic of what we think we should do, is there any data? And then you become that guide. And I think that's such a powerful place to sit, when, because it's so neutral, like none of the politics affects the analytics people. They're seen as just, it's like the guide.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think I've seen, I hear people all the time, they'll say things like, we don't really have data to tell us what to do one way or another on that. So maybe we don't, but we have data on something that's related to this topic. I guarantee it. If we're in it, then we have data. And if we're not in it, somebody else is in it. And we can go find third-party data. We can go somewhere else. And so I also think, like, always having, even if it's not in the moment, even if it's not in that meeting with your VP or whatever, if you can come back with a perspective in a couple days that just says, hey, honestly, we don't have anything on this, or we could get something on this, but it's going to take a while to get it right. But having that firm perspective on, here's how we could answer this question, invaluable, absolutely invaluable. Mm-hmm. Because like you said, yeah. I do think analysts get looked at as, hey, guide us, tell us what to do. And this idea of being like, I only have access to this one database and it doesn't tell me anything about this. It's not a very compelling answer, but it's also not like everything that's possible. There's always something that we could look at or do.
Yeah. Do you have any advice when you're purchasing data, when you're looking at third-party data to bring in to answer questions? How do you evaluate different data vendors?
Yeah, great question. I get data vendors in my inbox multiple times a day. I think one thing that I definitely didn't appreciate until more recently is just how interconnected a lot of them are. There are so many vendors that have sprung up that are all, in one way or another, probably pinging the same few underlying data sources. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but I think a lot of them also are getting like staler and staler as cookies go away as well. And so the first thing is, if you have an existing data vendor, this is like advice number one that I would have, is if you have an existing data vendor and you're at a conference or you're at a happy hour or whatever, you learn about some data source that sounds really interesting, there's probably a good chance that your existing data vendor can get you that data without working with, at least for companies that I've worked with, if you need to pull in a new data vendor, you're talking about legal and IT resources and all sorts of other teams that you'd have to tap in order to get that new data source, versus existing vendors typically tends to be easier. And so the first thing is, if you hear about interesting data from one area or from one vendor, don't necessarily assume that's the only place you can get that piece of information. And then, I'm sorry, your question was like specifically what's, I guess I lost the question itself.
No, that's great. Just any advice around when you're buying third-party data, how do you approach it? I think it's great. Start with your current partners instead of just going straight for an outside third party.
Yep. And I guess by current partners, I also meant like that probably is also a third party. I guess the other piece is like what you're trying to do with it. So there's a lot of data that we use, let's say, for understanding where our members are to send them their, we have an annual reward. So We mail that to you physically at your house. We also remind you, for our better members, we're reminding them 3 times a year or more about coupons that they have available that they could use, or different events that we have going on. So as we like have that sort of data, which is just, it's simple. It's here's your address. Understanding what the limitations of that data are. So a lot of times there's data living in databases and you don't necessarily know what you can or can't do with it. And so another piece is, are you allowed to, for instance, create a new mover campaign if you notice that someone moves in your database? That's actually a separate license that you have to buy from that data. And then another piece of that then is, what's value add to an analysis versus data activation, and when can you bundle those? So let's say you want to understand like the potential spend of your customers. So you're looking at something like estimated income or estimated wealth at a household level. There is data that you can get on that to analyze your customers, but that same data, maybe for only a little bit more, you could also use to activate that data. Let's say like within a data management platform, or maybe in social channels or elsewhere. And so just understanding like what's the usage, I think, is really important. And then if you are only looking at it for activation, there are becoming more and more very cheap or even free ways of targeting customers, especially in social, where you don't have to actually buy any data to do it. So that's another piece that's, I think, emerging, getting better, and is interesting.
Do you think that the future of the data industry is getting bleaker because of the privacy regulations?
I don't know about bleaker. From what I've seen, I have more limited visibility into maybe like cookie, what I would call like cookie derived attributes and how effective they are. The times I have tried to use those in analysis or for targeting purposes, it's been less comprehensive and less predictive than other signals we have about customers. And frankly, like over a decade ago now, but like students as well. And so I think there probably are uses for that cookie level aggregated data. But I think they're, one, yes, I guess I agree that that's going to be less and less useful. But also, if you have a business that's heavily reliant on that, like that's where I'd be worried. If you're not using a lot of it today, I definitely wouldn't necessarily advise starting. But yeah, I guess I haven't seen a lot of value in it personally, except for targeting. But I think generally speaking, with cookie deprecation, I think we're going to see more contextual targeting. And I think that brings us like full circle now, actually, where I think MTA is going to become less common. Media mix is going to become more common. We're going to just do a lot more in terms of understanding holistically what something is doing versus very specifically, what are all the ways that we reach this customer across the internet?
Interesting. What do you mean by full circle?
Oh, in our conversation.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Because we were talking about MTA maybe 40 minutes ago.
Yeah. I was thinking maybe back in the day they did.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Maybe
yeah.
Big picture MMM. I mean,
Totally. No, but actually, right? Like I wasn't around then, but there was, I was around, I guess, but I wasn't doing this then. But yeah, back when it was print catalog, analog radio, TV, maybe cable. Yeah, I guess truly full circle. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do think though there's some really interesting cookieless integrations that are happening where, again, like vendor by vendor, from a marketing channel perspective, I think you're still going to have measurement. It just won't be stitched across in the same way like it can be today.
It's basically creating, it's not no longer a walled garden, it's like a walled farm. You have multiple gardens that now there's a wall around all of them. And they can share data in between themselves, but it doesn't exit that. And then it becomes even more valuable for them. And even more unattainable to compete with. But that's very interesting that there is not only these walled gardens that are proliferating, but they're starting to combine.
Definitely. And I think your point about, will there be more competition in the future? And the answer, I think it's like not in the current setup. I think there will be more and more moats put around these data providers and marketing solutions because of the policy changes. And I think it's just going to be harder and harder to prove value as a new solution, and especially in like the digital marketing and consumer acquisition space, where you're not using first party data.
Yeah, it's almost like it's getting harder and harder to optimize better than the algorithms that these companies own. And they, if they can, because the only reason you would beat them is if you had the same data and you ran better modeling. But if they can keep the data, it's really hard to beat it.
Yeah, I think that's true. Which I do think, though, that creates an opportunity also then for existing companies with large data sets that they can mine themselves. I think it's going to be harder to also then become a new retailer if you're putting your similar product in the same algorithm that a company with a much larger budget than you can put their products in that same algorithm. And then if all the algorithms that you are relying on as that newcomer business are those third-party algorithms versus like an 86-year-old or 200-year-old company, not that you have to be that old to have a legacy database with existing customers to mine, probably only like maybe 3 years or 5 years to really build that up. But once you have that, then you actually know potentially which of your existing customers you should expect to see shop with you this summer. And that's not something that a TikTok algorithm is going to know, but it is something that you can determine from your own data. And then you can become more precise and surgical in how you invest your dollars against those audiences. Mm-hmm. So I do think, I totally agree with you that you're not going to be able to develop an algorithm that's smarter than Tox or potentially even, definitely, I wouldn't say Google in the near future, but even some of these smaller players like a Snap or whatever. But I do think if you're being as explicit as do target this audience or exclude this audience, I think that's something that brands can do on top of those algorithms to make their investments go further.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Awesome. This has been such a great conversation, Max. I want to thank you again for joining the podcast.
Yeah, pleasure was mine. Thanks, Alex. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you soon.